This meeting of the Senate Environment and Energy Committee will come back to order. And the Senator Dahl's bill, I think, will be fairly quick, and we're going to start with that bill. Senator Dahl, welcome to the committee again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will not be talking about renewable energy at this time, but I do have Senate File 971. This is a bill that trying to get ahead of some issues that may be coming our way in terms of making sure we can get rid of the nitrates in our water system. Actually, a summary that just came out yesterday from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency said about this particular study, portions of four major watersheds in southwest Minnesota lie in the Missouri River Basin. And a recent study assessed 93 of 181 stream sections for aquatic life or aquatic recreation. Of these, only three were considered fully supporting of aquatic life. 53 sections were non-supporting of aquatic life, and 31 non-supporting of aquatic recreation. None of the lakes in the Missouri River Basin met the aquatic recreation standard. And, of course, our drinking water, recreation, aquatic life uses are affected by high nitrate. And we believe that a good approach would be a watershed approach to trying to get a hold of, in cooperation with our farmers, our Board of Water and Soil Conservation districts, to try to do what we can to get ahead of the issue. Eventually, I imagine there will be some regulation about the amount of nitrates in our water. So I'm going to turn it over to my testifier, and I'll fill in any gaps, or she can answer any questions specific about the bill, which she will also address.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Lewis.
Thank you, Chair members. My name is Melissa Lewis. I'm the Water Plan and Policy Coordinator at the Board of Water and Soil Resources. The Board of Water and Soil Resources supports the ideas of the nitrate reduction program outlined in Senate File 971, but is neutral on the bill itself. Many of the mechanisms outlined in the bill to achieve a nitrate reduction program are already possible through other policy or budget bills, including the One Watershed, One Plan program authorized by the legislature in 2012, supported through clean water funds in the governor's budget, and the One Watershed, One Plan agency bill, Senate File 1433. The first three objectives of the proposed nitrate program, building local watershed management capacity by developing leadership among landowners and others in the watersheds impaired by nitrates, strengthening partnerships among technical providers, educators, and landowners through working groups led by local citizens at the watershed level, and building local capacity to assess water quality, establish water quality goals, targets, and implement practices to address nitrates and measure impacts. These three objectives are all consistent with sound watershed management principles, as well as with the One Watershed, One Plan program mentioned. What Senate File 971 would do, in addition, is increase the legislative emphasis and priority on reduction of nitrates in those watersheds with nitrate impairments. This is important, but I do mention that no nitrate standard is yet established. The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency projects a standard is about 2 to 3 years away. The fourth objective of the proposed nitrate program, to provide incentive payments to assist with and encourage implementation of water quality best management practices, is currently possible through the federal EQIP program. What Senate File 971 will do is provide state funds in addition to these federal funds, specifically for nitrate reduction best management practices. Finally, to meet the objectives of noted, the bill requires Bowser to assign watershed coordinators to support interested parties in meeting objectives of the bill, establish guidance for establishing goals and evaluating progress in the watersheds, and developing incentive payment rates and award grants to participating individuals and entities to reduce nitrates. These requirements could be achieved in part through multiple local government staff leaders and existing state staff. In closing, most of the objectives and requirements of the bill are already possible. If the One Watershed, One Plan program is passed and funded, Bowser will be back before you in the future to describe the results and note where additional legislation may be helpful. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you very much, Ms. Lewis. Is there questions from the committee? Senator Osmick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Senator Dahl, myself and Senator Scalzi sit on the Clean Water Council. Nitrates is one of their priorities. They are spending a lot of legacy money on this effort Could you please describe why the state needs to appropriate general fund or money out of the general fund when we're already using a lot of Clean Water Council money to make an impact on this?
Mr. Chair and Senator Osmond, I think we're just trying to beef up with coordination of Bowser some of the coordination, the leadership roles that might be helpful in primarily a voluntary program for our farmers. I think there's room for improvement. I appreciate the work that's already being done. I think that, again, as mentioned by Ms. Lewis here, that you know, these are some proposals that are still going to be coming forward. So, you know, we have some room for improvement on that. So, you know, I don't have a dollar amount here. I'm not, that's not my goal. If this could be done within the existing framework, it'd be great. But I think there probably is going to be some needed resources to do what the bill hopes to accomplish.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Osmond.
So for the efforts that are currently going on with the Clean Water Council, what parts of their components of their programs are not satisfactory that are requiring this type of effort?
Mr. Chair, I do not sit on that particular committee, and I don't know. You'd probably know better, but if you have specific concerns about or areas that you think that they could do better, I would be glad to hear them.
Well, Mr. Chair, I didn't bring the bill. I mean, I'm a little concerned here that we're creating duplicative services outright within the state when we're currently devoting many resources from the Clean Water Council to accomplish exactly or in similar vein the things that you're trying to do here. I guess I'd move on to another question. You don't have a dollar figure here. I mean, can you provide some type of guidance on how much administrative costs you're going to have versus the actual program costs that actually accomplish something? Do you have any idea on describing that?
Well, I think they're working on a fiscal note on that right now, and so I do not have exact numbers on that for you.
Thank you.
The Department of Agriculture, Mr. Cruz here. Mr. Cruz, are you ready to testify as well? I think perhaps hear from them.
Mr. Chair, Santo Cruz, Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and you just gave me every agency liaison's worst nightmare. You caught me whispering and said my name in committee, so I didn't know that we were being called up. I brought with me today a real expert, Greg Bezicki, the leader of our Pesticide Fertilizer Management Division. The department is the lead on nitrogen and groundwater issues. We have some activities going on, and we wanted to share some of that good work with you here today within the context of Senator Dahl's bill.
Mr. Bezicki, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Greg Bezicki, and I would just like to correct Mr. Cruz's testimony. I'm not really the expert. The experts are back at the office. I just have the privilege of representing them. But I would like to say that the nitrate issue is a very serious issue. There's a lot of work that's actually taking place right now, and maybe the best way to explain it is that it is tremendously complex. As Senator Osmond said, there is a significant amount of clean water funds that are coming to our agency to deal with nitrates. Our focus is groundwater protection, and in the very near future, we're going to be announcing or presenting the revision of the nitrogen fertilizer management plan that was first developed after the passage of the Groundwater Protection Act 25 years ago, and it's been updated. It's been out for comment. We're talking about it, and it's in its final stage of revision. Now, that plan does focus on groundwater. Let me be perfectly clear, Mr. Chair. But it is a plan that has been developed with a lot of input from the ag community and as well as with the other agencies. And of course, there is a surface water-groundwater interaction that takes place. The Minnesota Department of Agriculture has this responsibility because we are the state lead agency for the regulation and the development of best management practices for fertilizer as well as pesticides. We've been doing that for a number of years, and with the great help of the clean water funds, we've been able to accelerate that in recent years. So we have a number of best management practices that we have been promoting around the state. Those are very focused on voluntary, and we will continue to focus on the voluntary. But the committee should be aware that the nitrogen fertilizer management plan does have a regulatory component. It's not the feature of it. It is actually something that we're going to implement if the voluntary practices are not effective. And in fact, earlier this summer, the commissioner did announce that he was going to be moving towards rule writing as soon as we finalize the plan on some specific fertilizer practices. These are things that, such as fall application in areas on sandy soils and things that really are poor practices. And the commissioner is going to embark on this rule writing provision. And so we'll be moving it forward both in a voluntary emphasis, but also looking at some regulations that restrict practices that basically most farmers don't practice to a large extent anyways, but it does have a regulatory component. If the chair is agreeable, certainly we do have some fact sheets on the nitrogen fertilizer management plan. I'd be happy to share with the committee. And then I also for the committee's interest, tomorrow morning we actually as part of this activity in promoting the voluntary practices, we have a really an outstanding meeting with growers in the ag community up in St. Cloud. I'm passing out the brochure. But this is part of just the ongoing regular activities that take place in the agricultural community right now to make sure that growers and the industry folks really understand the seriousness of nitrates and that there are solutions and practices that can be implemented. So, Mr. Chair, if you've got any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sorry, I have Mr. Cruz's name. I didn't write down your name. I apologize.
Greg Pizicki.
Mr. Pizicki, as I'm reading the legislation, I'm hearing you talk about the Department of Ag's role in working with farmers to reduce nitrates. Now we're shifting to yet another entity, the Board of Water and Soil Resources. I get concerned when we have people who maybe don't understand or respect the agricultural heritage of our state, how farming as an industry evolves and changes, how expensive ideas in St. Paul can be for farmers. I get very concerned that the Department of Ag isn't in here anywhere. And I see the Department of Agriculture is on the testifiers list. Is the Department of Agriculture not doing an adequate job in working on reducing this, that we need to create yet another entity with yet more power and yet more government? So if you could address that for me, please.
Mr. Cruz.
Mr. Chair and Senator Benson, you will never get the Department of Ag on record saying we're not doing a good enough job. So you have perfectly crafted your question for me to say absolutely not. You may get different answers from different stakeholders and maybe even different agencies, but we're very proud of the work we do at the Department of Ag.
And Mr. Cruz, though, related to that, if you are trying to do some work to reduce nitrates, I mean, how does your relationship with Bowser work on in terms of that, in terms of who's doing the work on the ground?
Mr. Chair, we work, we coordinate through the executive branch with all the state agencies, including Bowser, on these issues. Frankly, the funding that came through the Clean Water Funds, And of course, you've got members of the Clean Water Council here. In my opinion, I've been working in this area for many years. But that funding has actually enabled agencies to work together in a much more cooperative fashion than ever before. We have funds to work on some of these projects. A good example of the cooperation is actually the development of the nitrogen fertilizer management plan, in which we actually had not only environmental groups, but of course the ag community and the state agencies involved in that 2-year process. So there is a cooperative effort that is underway right now. We intend to be working, continuing that cooperative effort on whether it's monitoring or promotion of practices, and Bowser is certainly a sister agency that's an important player in delivering services.
I guess my question, which may relate to Senator Benson's one, is that if we were putting money into this, I mean, I get your point that you'd like Department of Agriculture be the one that would be handling this. And when you're putting out a new plan, you said the management plan. At that time, you're looking at what you said, something rule making or whatever is that comes out whenever that happens. What's the role of ag and where does Bowser fit in?
Mr. Chair, the Department of Agriculture is the lead agency for the regulation of fertilizer and pesticides. That's all components of that regulatory, with a few minor exceptions. But we're really the state lead agency on that, and we have developed best management practices for a number of years, and we have revised this plan to protect groundwater. In doing so and delivering this, this is going to be we're going to work with our sister agencies in a cooperative fashion, but we will be in the lead.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize for showing up late. So I guess I'm a little confused, Senator Dahl, and perhaps the department can answer the subdivision 3, line 22 on page 1. The board shall establish guidance to be used by watersheds in establishing their goals and methods for evaluating progress. Wouldn't this board have to go to the Department of Ag's website and work with the department to figure out the goals? I mean, because if they're the lead agency on nitrate reduction program, where else are they going to get their information to develop another program on top of what the department's already doing? Where's that information going to come if it doesn't come from the Department of Ag? So it's kind of an open-ended question.
Mr. Chair, I look at the bill in its entirety, I think what our goal here is, I mean, it could be individual goals. It could be the coordinator working with the farmer to establish conservation goals. It's about building trust and leadership in terms of, you know, our entire infrastructure of those people that are out there working with farmers and so forth. As I read this report, it's called Farm to Stream. It came from the Freshwater Society recommendations for accelerating soil and water stewardship. It talks about the need to build local capacity. I have to read maybe a little bit of this guy theory. If a relationship based on a program succeed and attract and retain farmer participant, it had to have the guy. This is the trusted person to whom farmers can talk to, who will knock on farmers' door to engage them in conversations about conservation practices appropriate for each farmer's operation. But the guy theory also creates the guy paradox, that when the guy leaves the organization for whatever reason, that leaves the program based on personal relationships with farmers, and the guy starts over from the ground up. So by placing an actual coordinator in each of those watershed areas, we hopefully can get rid of the guy paradox. And in terms of Senator Benson talking about, you know, another government agency, this report, which this bill is based on the report, and it says the last thing things farmers hate most is we're here to help. To hear that, well, we know what the hell we're doing. We know we can do stuff better and we'll try it, but the whole I'm from the government and we're here to help, or I'm from this group and I'm here to help, doesn't fly with farmers. And so that's what we're trying to put into place, building up the infrastructure with people on the ground that are trained to try to set goals with the cooperation of our watershed districts, our Department of Agriculture, and most importantly, our farmers, to try to incentivize or to create plans and goals that ultimately will result in nitrate reduction. So, you know, I'm not getting this. This is not my bill particularly. I'm carrying it for a House author, but I am buying into the principles of that we should do something. We should get ahead of this in the next few years. So the specifics maybe need to be ironed out, but hopefully you understand the general principles that are behind the actual bill.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dahl, I'm an old retired agronomist. Can it be, instead of a guy, can it be a gal?
Yeah, you know, Mr. Chair, and it does say guy or
not
gal was in there one other time.
But
sorry.
Senator Vincent.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'm confused. The Department of Agriculture put out this plan. The commissioner is moving to rulemaking because he already has enforcement provisions. I would think it would make more sense that if we were going to establish a bunch of guys, it would be in the Department of Agriculture because they have nexus with the farming community, instead of taking an entire another bureaucracy, trying to get them up to speed on what the Department of Ag's already doing. I don't know where our soil and water conservation districts fit in this. I feel like we're ignoring the resources that we have for the sake of hiring coordinators. Not that I'm a big fan of FTEs, but if the Department of Ag needs a couple people to go out and develop a relationship so that in the rulemaking process the farmers are heard and best practices move forward without punishment, maybe we need an incentive program that's talked about here, but it's Department of Ag responsibility, not the Board of Soil and Water Resources or Water and Soil Resources.
We have Mr. Jasky here. Maybe you want to speak to this. I mean, because I think who does what, I think, is a good appropriate question.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members, John Jasky, Director of Board of Water and Soil Resources, and Senator Benson's question. This is not an agency bill, of course, as you know, but the way I understand this bill to work would be that the soil and water conservation districts, those local agents, are the people that work with the landowners, whether they're farmers or anyone else, to do the voluntary practices on their property to minimize the nitrate problems. And so that's an existing statute, that's an existing infrastructure, it's an existing funding stream. And as Mr. Buzicki said, the plan that they're working on will help both direct that solution through additional voluntary work and potentially through some additional requirements through rulemaking.
I'm not sure whether this is for Senator Dahl or whomever, but I'm wondering if I think the thing you're trying to address is the sense that the voluntary stuff hasn't been working, trying to get some of the people who work with the farmers to get some funding to do it. I'm wondering if this is the kind of thing that maybe an amendment or something, not today. I don't think we think it needs more discussion than that, but to have it where it might be going through. And again, I don't know timelines for the Department of Agriculture stuff, but if when plan is coming, whether it might work through there, but the funding get to Bowser.
Mr. Chair, yes, that's a very good idea. I think that the Nitrogen Fertilizer Management Plan will be out in weeks, not months, to kind of put a finer point on it for everybody, because I think that part of what this bill seeks to address, and I think it's an entirely fair diagnosis of what of what's out there, it will be addressed in the Nitrogen Fertilizer Management Plan. Once that's released, I think we'll have a great relationship working with Senator Dahl and Clark Johnson in the House, and we can kind of see where this would fit and how it would progress forward, you know, before the session ends, so that people feel the need to, if they think that there's, you know, ways that it can be improved, we're there for it, or if they think it's sufficient, then maybe we don't need to move forward with anything further. It's really a question for people once they've actually seen the plan, and I'm right now here telling you that, you know, wait and don't do anything and we'll take care of it. Well, that's not really fair if we wait until May 19th. So we will work to get the final stages of the plan updated and out to you all so that it can be available for public consumption, and as well as any work with Senator Dahl or Representative Clark Johnson.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. I think everybody at the Capitol, and I think all the the appropriate groups have are working on nitrate. That's a very important issue. What I do know is that farmers in our ag community expect and want a one-stop shop, and not something that's complicated. And so I think if, as Senator Benson said, perhaps we need to give more resources to the Department of Ag and take their recommendations seriously, beef them up, something. But if it takes ongoing communication to make sure that everybody's taken care of, this issue is taken care of appropriately, but to add it another complex, like where is this farmer going to get his information and who is he going to contact, I'm a little concerned about that. I'd like to just make it easier for everybody.
And maybe on that, maybe what we could do is, I mean, obviously whether this is funded or not is something for the Finance Committee, not for here, but I think we would want to make sure that the funding, before we get to the funding for it, the policy portion of it is where, how this would happen. So I guess maybe what I'll suggest is that Senator Dahl and his house author and the department and Bowser work together on what kind of language you'd want, and then when the plan comes out, which I hope is sooner rather than later, so people can make, legislature can make more appropriate decisions, then could deal with it. Obviously, maybe we don't deal with it today, but we take a look at it. We have a couple more weeks, three more weeks till deadline, but try and find out, because I think Senator Dahl's trying to get some of the on-the-ground folks who deal with it, as Mr. Jaski said, get funding, but I also understand the department's concern about that it's the agency that does the regulatory part of it, so maybe we can do that and have you guys do some talking with each other in the meantime and hurry up with the plans.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to work with the Department of Ag especially, and your points, suggestions were well taken, all from the whole committee.
Senator Osmick, do you have a comment?
Yeah, I think you also need to take into account that the Clean Water Council, this is right in the wheelhouse of them, and I think they should be front and center of any of this discussion. I hate to say it, but and I, with all due respect to the author, this is not ready for prime time, because there are way too many questions, and the fact that Clean Water Council has already made this such a chief focus of their ongoing operations. They may already have plans and have things set up, and we've sat through them. Senator Scholes, we'll admit, we've sat through many presentations on this, that maybe they all need to get together in a room, and maybe it may not be in this legislative session or this legislative year. Maybe next year you can come with a fleshed out plan, because it just feels like this is going to create two different channels, and we're going to spend twice as much money when we don't have to, and we can get one-stop shop, as Senator Rosen said, to go in the right direction the first time. So that's why I'm saying I don't think this is ready for prime time.
Well, Senator Scalzi.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think there's some frustrations with people in the farming community and in the environmental community, that we know what the problems are. We're trying to get solutions, and that may have precipitated this, because we're trying to work through crop advisors and many other people who work with farmers to use less nitrates, which sometimes cause pollution if there's too much on the ground. So it's the kind of thing, I think, is coming from frustration that things aren't happening in the manner that people would like to see them happen. And I think that's why this bill is coming. I shouldn't say that, because I don't know why that's coming, but I sense that a little bit.
I think it's a good, so in other words, my encouragement that that Bowser and the department and Senator Dahl work together, and Sir Osmick's and Scalzi's comments about engaging the Clean Water Council may help as well, because Senator, Mr. Cruz.
Mr. Chair, if I may address what Senator Scalzi said, you're absolutely right. The one thing I wanted to just kind of gets down to the scientific level of nitrates in groundwater. One thing that I find myself again and again addressing with stakeholders and non-farm groups is that even if farmers applied no nitrogen, we would still have nitrogen getting into the groundwater through nitrification, through natural processes. Similar with arsenic. Farmers aren't out there spreading arsenic on their fields, yet through natural processes of mineralization, it does get into the groundwater. So I do understand the frustration of different stakeholders saying, are farmers doing enough to preserve the groundwater? Yet I want to be clear that it's not only farmers' responsibility and it's not all their fault. Much of this comes from the natural processes and the chemistry in the ground already.
Thank you. With that, I think what we'll do is set the bill aside for now and ask you to keep working on it. And as the, again, depending on the timing of the plan and so on, that could fit in very well with fixing this up in a way it could be useful. So, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Committee.
Senator Rest, we'll take up Senate File 1099. Welcome to the committee today.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. It is my pleasure to bring to the committee Senate File 1099, and I will be going through it, the major sections of it, and then ask you to hear testimony from a variety of people. I think you have the names. The Senate File 1099 is an extension of the law passed in 2009 dealing with the, or what was commonly called the Toxic Free Kids Act. And we have dealt with these issues over the over that interim period. And this is a governor's initiative to continue working on making products that are generally available safer for children. So I'll just go through the bill. I think most of you are familiar with it. We have seen some of these issues before. There are some refinements here, but I won't. I'll let the testifiers talk about the general principles that are in it. Section 1 is a reference to the Data Practices Act, and I have spoken with counsel for Judiciary. If this bill is successful in this committee and Health and Human Services, it would be referred to Judiciary because there is a Data Practices sections that are dealt with in the bill. Section 2 adds some definitions to the sections of the statutes that are dealt with by the PCA and the Department of Health, including contaminant at lines 2.19, 2.35, the definition for this bill of a practical quantification limit, indicating what can be measured. In the internal to that definition is the reference to agency, which means the PCA, and department, which means the Department of Health. I'm sure that this committee is familiar with the terms product category, and I had to look up, and I must tell you on the internet what a brick level of a GS1 global product classification standard was, but if you really want to know, I can talk about it. But the word brick just means it is a term that's used there, and it just means a building block to arrive at those standards, but they do refer to it within the industry as a brick. In Section 3, we begin the substance of the bill and ask for the department to review periodically the list of chemicals of high concern. Sometimes they're called priority chemicals, and that are, if there are any changes to that list, looking at 3.22, that they must be published in the department's website and the state register when a change is made. The thrust of the bill is to is a reporting requirement. It is to ask manufacturers that are putting products on the market with any one of the nine high priority or priority chemicals, the chemicals of high concern, to let the department know that those products contain one of those nine chemicals, and then the department would publish that on their website. This bill is not a ban on those chemicals in any way. It is simply creating a website, having the website have this information that is reported to it by manufacturers. Is the goal, on the other hand, to encourage, and they're all sticks and carrots in here, to encourage manufacturers of products to look for better alternatives, safer alternatives to the chemicals that are in these products, while still serving the market that the products have been originally designed for. Section 4, once again, talks about the reporting the establishment of the list of priority chemicals, that they have to be published again. They have to be made available to the public on the department's website and in the state register, and provide a 60-day comment period for the public. And after that, then they review them and consider any of those public comments about these products, chemicals, and they then publish a final list of changes. In Section 5, deals with the applicability of these chemicals and the exemption of food and food or beverage packaging is removed from the statutes at lines 5.7. The conditions 11 and 12 on page 5 establish the lower limits under which or below which a manufacturer is not required to make those kinds of reporting. Section 6 is a technical section. Section 7 gets into what the reporting would actually require, the content of it. We really are talking not about the incidental presence of these chemicals in products. Some of them, maybe not all of them, occur naturally, and that is not what the bill is directed toward in terms of the reporting requirement. It's talking about those chemicals that are on the list that are intentionally added to a product that is included in products that are aimed at children under 12. Having said that, I am pleased to tell you that my grandson is here with me today, and he would not be affected by this bill because he is over 12. So, well, he is 12. We do have a running dialogue. Anyway, he was very helpful to me a couple of years ago, or when we were doing the formaldehyde bill, in understanding and contributing to that discussion as a child who is exposed to these products. Section 7 really is the guts of the bill. It talks about, again, adding what's in that needs to be reported, the timing of the reports, the cycle of reporting. And then I mentioned that Section 1, that there was a reference to the data practices section, Chapter 13, and it does state now in this section that the data that is in these new sections that are being added to those 116 are to be regarded as public data, and that they are not to be considered as a misappropriation of trade secret data. There's also a process for removing priority chemical and the process that you would go through to accomplish that. The stick, in one stick at least, I guess you'd call it, is what if a manufacturer fails to report? Is that going to prevent the information being reported? No, the agency will have the authority to have an independent contractor examine the product and report whether one of those one or more of those nine chemicals are present in the product. Section 8 deals with the fees that would be collected to after the first 2 years, where the website will be set up and the program begun. In the governor's budget, there is a proposed appropriation for this biennium to take care of the expenses of doing that, and then following that in the out biennium, fees paid by the manufacturers for this service would be collected. Section 9 gives the PCA enforcement powers. And except if you look at Section 824, the manner that is provided in Section 115.071, and it lists the sections 1, 3, 4, 5, 6. It omits Section 2, so it is not given the enforcement powers with regard to criminal penalties. Section 10 is the carrot, and the way I look at it, at least, and it puts a duty on the part of the department to use fee revenue collected in excess of the cost of administering the program into grants, support for finding safer alternatives for these products. For the chemicals that are in these products that are otherwise harmful or toxic. It also puts a duty on the part of the department to accomplish education and research, and then as an accountability measure, a further accountability measure, to require the department to the agency, three agencies, PCA, Health, and Commerce, to report to this committee as well as a similar committee in the House of Representatives about how this, what's commonly called the Toxic Free Kids Act, has been implemented and evaluated. Mr. Chairman, that is the summary section by section of the bill, and I believe you do have a list of testifiers, and I would ask them to come forward at this time.
Thank you. Maybe we'll start with testifiers unless there are any questions from the committee before that. Okay. Dr. Bill Toscano. Maybe Ms. Spurgeon can come up to the table for the next presenter. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and go ahead.
I'm Bill Toscano. I'm a professor of environmental health sciences at the University of Minnesota School of Public Health. And I'm here to speak in favor of passing this bill. I think that the chemicals that are listed as the nine chemicals of concern are of great concern to the health of children and even of adults. And the reason for this great concern is that these chemicals are have a high affinity for intracellular receptors, which are chemical molecules in the cell which can amplify the exposure to the chemical to turn it on. Many of these are estrogenic compounds, like bisphenol A, which was at first synthesized as an estrogen with the idea that it would replace estrogen in women who could not produce enough estrogen. However, it was a weak estrogen, and it was replaced by diethylstilbestrol, But the large amount of data suggests that this compound, which is now used as a plasticizer, is actually polymerized to make things like polycarbonate bottles and linings of tin cans, etc., binds to the estrogen receptor and can have deleterious effects on, at least in animal studies. And one of the concerns is the so-called obesity, diabetes problem that's occurring now within the youth of our country and around the world. It turns out that in animal studies, at least, that exposure to bisphenol A at levels to which humans are exposed in mice produce animals that are overproducing insulin at birth. Now, if I were to give you a shot of insulin or increase your insulin level, if you kept your diet the same, you would gain weight and you would start to see obesity setting in. One of the other side effects you would see is lack of satiety, so you would tend to overeat. Another thing you would see is lethargy, so you would not exercise or could not exercise. And this is what we're actually seeing in the population. It's hard to say that, yes, it's only bisphenol A, but some of these compounds have similar actions that bind to estrogen receptors and affect hormone levels and hormonal diseases. And some of these are called obesogens. Another chemical on the list are phthalates. Phthalates, as you know, are used widely to make plastics softer and more chewable, like this rubber duck here. A rubber duck is not actually rubber, but plastic. And so when children would, when these were in toys and so on, children would suck on them, and then their exposure to the phthalates were very high. And so it's no surprise that you see things like obese kids coming more than we would have before. So I'm not saying that these are necessarily the causes, but these are levels of concern. The other chemicals on the list, such as the polybrominated compounds, are known to be carcinogens in animal studies, and they also have estrogenic or hormonal effects. And what these things do is they change the signals within the body. So right now you're sitting digesting your lunch, there's signals that tell you, oh, it's time to digest the lunch, or we're listening to this character talk about this stuff, and I want to go to sleep, or I want to go home. All these things are very, very tightly regulated signals within your body. And during development for children under 5 and under 12, these are still going on very high levels. You're still developing at very high rates. But when these chemicals get within the body, they mimic some of the natural chemicals, natural signaling of the chemicals, and they alter them. So they give a confusing signal to the body, and then this could result in disease. Now, some people will argue that these are safe. These compounds are entirely safe. And oftentimes that's done because the effects are subtle. People don't look for little fat kids being born. In fact, when I was born and was overweight, my mother fed me like crazy, and that was considered to be healthy. But probably it's not healthy. And if you were exposed to these kinds of chemicals before you were born or after birth, you would tend to overeat. And the food that we're eating, of course, is another issue of the exposure. So the other chemicals on the list are common, lead, still with us. Sadly, as we thought it was all gone, I used to think that lead is no longer a problem, but still is with us. Little toy play things, little highly colored, colorful products that are imported often have lead in them to enhance the color. And formaldehyde, of course, is in clothing, and it has been there for some time and can pose a problem. So I thank you for your attention, and I'm open to any questions you may have.
Thank you. Questions from the committee. Dr. Toscano, I had never heard endocrine disruptors being related to obesity and, you said, diabetes types,
yeah,
of conditions.
These are now, the new data are coming out that they're now called, some of them are obesogens. That is, in studies, they help to make fat cells. And in the laboratory, we can do this by taking something like a stem cell, add insulin to it, and add some of these chemicals to it, and bloop, you get these little green globules of fat cells that you can produce. And we think the data seem to be indicating that these are actually causing this to happen in humans as well. And once the fat cells are there, they're never gone.
Thank you. Ms. Spurgeon. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Diana Spurgeon. My husband Trent and I live in Apple Valley and are proud parents to our six-year-old daughter Lily and our four-year-old son Quinn, although if he were here he would say he's 4 3/4. The desire to do the best that I can for my children began when I was pregnant with my first child. I was very careful to follow all the recommendations of my doctor, I ate a healthy diet, and I read all the popular books for expectant mothers. I also became educated on what chemicals to avoid due to their toxic effects on young developing children. Informed and determined, I was going above and beyond in providing the safest, healthiest environment for my child. Or at least that's what I thought. Although I had become quite informed about the toxic effects of chemicals such as BPA, phthalates, flame retardants, formaldehyde, and others, I still had no idea just how prevalent they were in everyday products. For example, only after my children had consumed countless jars of baby food and containers of formula did I learn about the presence of BPA in these products. I was devastated when I learned this. How could this have happened when I was so diligent? I had lived under the assumption that the regulatory systems in our state and nation protected children against harmful chemicals. But in fact, manufacturers are not required to tell consumers if they are using them in products that I buy for my kids. So with every new children's product I buy, it seems I have to do a research project to find the safest option. When my daughter started kindergarten, I set out to research school uniforms, something she would be wearing for over 9 hours every day. I learned that formaldehyde is among some of the chemicals used to make clothing stain, wrinkle, and fade resistant, very popular features in school uniforms. So I wrote to companies asking them about their use of chemical finishes. Many were upfront and confirmed that, yes, they were used. Others simply refused to tell me. My experience illustrates that no parent can be 100% informed on chemical safety or the chemical composition of every product they buy. And as a busy mom, I can only do so much. Minnesota needs a comprehensive policy like the Toxic Free Kids Act that will allow parents to know if some of the most harmful chemicals are lurking in the products we use for our children each and every day. And it is important to act now. I do not yet know what the effects the chemicals my children were exposed to at the most vulnerable time in their lives will be. I only wish that legislation would have been in place 6 years ago so that I would not have to wonder. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Ms. Spurgeon. Questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Shannon Gotthammer and Jim Kelly. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Shannon Lotthammer. I'm with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And with me, right behind me, are Jim Kelly with the Minnesota Department of Health and also Megan Verdeja with the Minnesota Department of Commerce. And our three agencies agree that amendments to the Toxic Free Kids Act are really needed to increase available information, enhance consumer awareness, and allow for informed choices, and to give manufacturers incentives to reduce problem chemicals in children's products. The proposed bill will meet this need in four key ways: by requiring manufacturers and distributors of children's products that contain priority chemicals to disclose that information to the Pollution Control Agency so we can make that available to the public. Secondly, through a joint consumer education and outreach effort that would be spearheaded by the Departments of Health and Commerce to get information about priority chemicals in children's products to consumers. And then third, by providing grants to accelerate the development of safer chemical alternatives to priority chemicals and their incorporation into children's products. And then finally, through a coordinated effort by the Pollution Control Agency and the Department of Commerce to ensure that there's compliance with the Toxic Free Kids Act amendments and also with the chemical restrictions and bans that have been previously enacted by the legislature. We believe that the outcomes of this proposal, these proposed amendments, are that consumers have the information they need to make informed choices about the products they purchase for themselves and their families, and that consumer demand then drives improvements in products being produced and sold in Minnesota. That also provides manufacturers and distributors with incentives to develop and market safer alternatives to priority chemicals, and also position Minnesota as a center for business innovation for toxic reduction. And finally, this would allow agencies to build on efforts to reduce the potential human health and ecological impacts of toxics and products, and again, enhance awareness of and compliance with existing chemical restrictions and bans. So thank you very much for the opportunity to testify, and we'd be happy to answer questions if you have any for us.
Thank you, Ms. Lothar. I assume that Mr. Kelly and Ms. Verdea are not asking to testify separately? Okay. Are there any questions from the committee for any of the witnesses? Thank you very much. We had two who wanted to speak in opposition to the bill, Mr. Quillis and Mr. Johnson. Might as well come up as well at the same time.
Welcome, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Tony Quillis, and I am the Director of Environmental Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Thank you for the time today to speak in opposition to Senate File 1099. Much to the chagrin of Senator Rest, I'm going to mention that the chamber supports updating TSCA, the Toxic Substances Control Act, and any review and amendments to that legislation on the federal level we are supportive of. But Senator Rest made it abundantly clear to me
that
there's not a lot going on in Washington these days, so don't go there. And I said, well, I don't have a pen to cross it off, but I'm going to go there. But, Mr. Chairman, seriously, the Chamber does support the updating of the Toxic Substances Control Act, better known as TSCA. And also, children's products are already heavily regulated on the federal level, whether it's at the Consumer Product Safety Improvement Act, through the Environmental Protection Agency, through the Food and Drug Administration, and at the state level through, as you just heard, through the Pollution Control Agency, the Department of Health, or through our Department of Commerce. Mr. Chairman, there are four concerns that we have with the bill that it is before you. And number one, it is that the information that is requested from manufacturers and retailers is duplicative. There is an extensive amount of data already available out there right now, and it doesn't seem that we should go and reinvent the wheel, if you will. The state of Washington, Maine, California, and Oregon already have information readily available and have reciprocal sharing agreements among themselves. But, Mr. Chairman, I think the most important part is I want to draw your attention. It used to be out of the University of Massachusetts Lowell, and now it's out of an organization called the Northeast Waste Management Officials Association, but it's called the Interstate Chemicals Clearinghouse, or IC2. And their goals are to avoid duplication and enhance the efficiency and effectiveness of state, local, tribal initiatives through collaboration and coordination. Their second goal is to build agency capacity to promote safer chemicals and products. And their third goal is to ensure ready access to high-quality chemical data and assessment methods. They have an incredible database, Mr. Chairman, and that database can be searched by state, by chemicals, by product types. They have 1,000 state and local policies in that database, and it goes all the way back to 1990. There are 11 states and 2 cities that are on that and members of the Interstate Clearinghouse, and the states range from, Mr. Chairman, if you will, California, Connecticut, Delaware, Maine, Massachusetts, Michigan, Oregon, Vermont, Washington, and the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and the Minnesota Department of Health are members of the IC2. So that data is available right now to our state agencies, Mr. Chairman. The second concern that we have has to do with the exemption section. The Washington State exemption section has 17 to 21 and ranges from roller skates to sporting equipment to bikes. But I'll let Kelsey concentrate mainly on the one that concerns us, and that's removing the food and beverage exemption here in Minnesota. So, Mr. Chairman, I'll move on, but I'll let Kelsey focus on that exemption section. But the third one is it's very costly to comply with what is before you today, Mr. Chairman. One of our retail members estimated that there could be up to 10,000 products affected in one of their stores. The toy industry alone in the state of Washington, through testing and reporting, spent over $25 million. And I'm going to give you an example how costly it would be here in Minnesota. And if you hear that roar, that will be me jumping up to go to the TV, Mr. Chairman, because St. Thomas Academy or Duluth East are locked in an overtime battle right now at the state high school hockey tournament.
Excuse me, Mr.
But let me give you an example. If I was a manufacturer of a hockey helmet and marketed it to children under 12 and had two types of helmets, one from children 0 to 6 and another one from children 6 to 12, Senator Sieben years ago introduced me to a product called BPA, and it is contained in those hockey helmets. So if I was a manufacturer of a hockey helmet, I would, and there was BPA in it, I would, the first time that I would have to register, I would have to give you $1,000. The next time, 2 years later, if I didn't take that BPA out, now I got to give you two. 2 years later, now I got to give you four. And I don't have just one helmet. I have a blue one. I have a black one. I have a red one. I have a green one. That's thousands of dollars for each time I register one of those hockey helmets. And more than likely, because that helmet, that chemical is in that helmet to prevent it from shattering when it hits the ice or the boards. More than likely, Mr. Chairman, they're not going to be able to take it out of there. They're going to try and find that replacement, but more than likely not. So we're concerned about the costs. And finally, Mr. Chairman, we're concerned about the misinformation that could be provided by the data that's requested. A mere presence of some of these chemicals does not cause concern or make them harmful. It's dose and exposure that is the big concern, Mr. Chairman. And I want to read from you right from the Department of Ecology at the State of Washington and right from their website before you go through and click to get the data. It says, the presence of a chemical in a children's product does not necessarily mean the product is harmful to human health and that there is any violation of existing safety standards or laws. The second bullet point says, the reporting triggers are not health-based values. And the last one says, this data should not be used to determine the safety of individual products. Mr. Chairman, again, to wrap up, there are four concerns for us, that the information is duplicative. We're worried about the exemption section and the confusion it would cause to retailers and manufacturers. It's very costly to comply to this requirement and mandate, Mr. Chairman, and we're worried that it's going to provide misinformation to consumers. I thank you for your time, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Quillis. Ms. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kelsey Johnson, and I am Director of State Affairs for the Grocery Manufacturers Association. GMA is the voice of more than 300 leading food, beverage, and consumer product companies that sustain and enhance the quality of life for hundreds of millions of people in the United States and around the globe. Founded in 1908, GMA helps its members produce safe products through a strong, ongoing commitment to scientific research, testing, and evaluation, and to providing consumers with the products, tools, and information they need to achieve a healthy diet and active lifestyle. Our concern with Senate File 1099 is that it adds a new, unnecessary regulation to the sale of food, beverage, and consumer products that will confuse consumers, likely increase their grocery costs, and limit their choices. Minnesota is the only state attempting to do this. There are currently 300,000 food and beverage products on the market. The food and beverage industry introduces 15,000 new products annually. A large percentage of these products would require reporting to the MPCA according to this legislation. The proposed language also requires reporting down to the UPC code, Universal Product Code. Each product may have between tens and hundreds of UPCs. The legislation will be difficult and costly to comply with and not provide consumers with any real public health benefit. The $1,000 fee per ingredient that doubles every 2 years, as well as the fees listed for contractor fee and state fee, will eliminate many products manufactured by smaller companies from the store shelves, again, hurting the consumer and driving the manufacturer out of state. Some of the chemicals listed as priority chemicals are naturally occurring in the environment, and to completely eliminate their presence is not possible. The legislation ignores comprehensive and extensive safety measures already in place and their federal regulatory authorities, including the Consumer Product Safety Commission, the Food and Drug Administration, the Environmental Protection Agency, the Federal Trade Commission, the Food Safety Inspection Service, the United States Department of Agriculture, and many others. Our association recognizes the need for changes and has worked diligently to reduce the amount and use of priority chemicals within the food, beverage, and consumer products we produce. We also are strong advocates on the federal level for updating the Food Safety Modernization Act and the Toxic Substances Control Act. GMA supports strong federal food safety and chemicals management systems. These are national issues, not limited to a single state. When a state does act, GMA supports a scientific, effective, risk-based approach. Thank you for your time and the opportunity to testify on behalf of this very important issue to our industry. We respectfully oppose the legislation.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. Questions from the committee? Senator Benson.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. I'm trying to find it, and I'm not. You talk about what the manufacturers would have to report. We're a major food manufacturer. Does this pose a systemic economic risk?
Yes, it would. And were you looking, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Senator, were you looking for a particular part of the reporting requirement?
I was looking for the provisions that particularly pertain to your issues, and I'm getting caught in the kids' stuff here as I pass through, and I apologize.
Mr. Chairman. I would direct Senator Benson's attention to, in particular, the page 5, lines 5, 7, and 8, where the exemption food or beverage packaging is removed. And I think that's the core of the comments then being made by Ms. Johnson in objecting on behalf of the grocers to that exemption being removed. And that was the second point that Mr. Quillis brought up and the four objections, major objections that the chamber has.
Sarah Benson.
And Mr. Chair, with producers like General Mills, Cargill, ConAgra, CHS Harvest States, we have a lot of packaging designers here. They might just find it easier to contract somewhere else and not sell in Minnesota. So I think we need to be very thoughtful about what we do to our food industry. General Mills just went through some pretty major restructuring. Target's going through restructuring. While they're not a food manufacturer specifically, they do have their own Market Pantry and Archer Farms brand. So I really would like a lot more information on Minnesota's food industry before and really how flexible and how quickly they could move and what it does to their national brand distribution.
Are there questions or Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm going to just state the obvious that it really is time to stop poisoning our children and causing all sorts of cancers and obesity and other diseases. I'm more concerned about that than somebody's bottom line. Maybe that makes me a terrible person, but we've got to protect when children are developing and in the most vulnerable part of their development, to be giving BPA in the lining of baby food when you're feeding that to someone who's under a year old. That's pretty scary to me. So I think this is a wonderful bill, and I thank Senator Rust for carrying it.
Sir Osmick.
Mr. Chair, in reference to those comments, I guess is your cure worth unintended consequences of costs? As it was described by Mr. Quillis, you know, some of these chemicals are in hockey helmets. I mean, you may feel it is good to make this happen where if a kid goes into the boards, shatters his helmet, and becomes a hockey paraplegic like Jack Jablonski, I think is his name, I think he would have something to comment on regarding taking away that chemical that could have perhaps saved him from being a paraplegic. So I would be careful in taking chemicals out that may actually be able to save, in other instances, save people's lives. Same thing goes with BPA, that while it lines containers, it also protects the food that could be something that injures or makes people sick. So I grant you it would be nice to have some of these chemicals replaced with things that don't have the same consequences, but there are side benefits to these, though people may not want to recognize them.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest.
I would, in response to both comments, that, you know, I think that the genius of American society is its creativity, its ability to seek new solutions to problems that we are no longer willing to accept as detrimental effects on our lives together. And part of what's in this bill is to provide incentives not to have helmets, hockey helmets, that don't keep our children and our young men and women safe, but to do it in a way that does not have a harmful side effect, to encourage the research. And I think that is part of what our country, quite frankly, does the best. It's an idea society, and we routinely win Nobel Prizes in chemistry and physics, and those are not just theoretical activities. They do have practical effects. We fund a lot of research at the university, and it comes back to us tenfold at least in making our environment and our families safer. And I appreciate Senator Osmet's comments that you're not going to get rid of every single harmful effect of some things that you that because you want something, you want the benefit. What this bill does, though, is not to prevent you from making that choice, because you will know, because these products will have to report the chemicals that are in them. You'll just know that. It's not saying you don't have to have them, that they won't be available. It's just saying that the parents, like the lady that testified earlier, when her little girl starts to play hockey, that she can go to a website and she can find out what that product actually contains, and if the benefit, the safety benefit, outweighs what she would otherwise consider a harmful effect. This bill does not ban the products themselves. So I would just ask you to keep that in mind as we consider these enhancements to the Toxic Free Kids Act.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sieben.
I just wanted to clarify for the record, too, because I carried that legislation that Mr. Quillis referred to earlier. So Minnesota does ban BPA in baby bottles, sippy cups, baby food, and formula cans. And we passed a piece of that earlier that I didn't carry, and then I don't remember who did. Perhaps it was you, Senator Rest. And then I carried this legislation to ban BPA and baby food and baby food jars and formula cans. And we heard some of the same arguments then, that this would be a real impediment to the industry here in Minnesota, and that, you know, it was going to mean the end of baby food for families. And that's simply not the case. And so I welcome Senator Rest's bill here, because it's a step in the right direction. Minnesota already has this list of priority chemicals, and what this is doing is building on that registry. So it's saying now that children's products, only children's products, for only these priority chemicals, that there's proven scientific knowledge that it can have harmful effects on human health, especially on children's health, that now we're moving in the right direction. It's not banning the chemicals, which was what my legislation did specifically for BPA, or Senator Rest, your legislation did that Jacob helped you pass for formaldehyde. This is saying let the public have more information so that parents like me, who sometimes, Senator Scalzi and I were talking about this, sometimes feel overwhelmed because we want to make what's in the best health decision for our children,
it's not readily available. What is the best decision, as the testifier earlier said? And so this is moving in that direction of providing more information in a way that I don't find, by reviewing Senator Rest's language, is overly burdensome, but will provide families with information that will be helpful for them to make more informed decisions.
Katie. Sorry, I wasn't watching who had hands up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Rest, respectfully, research is idea-driven, not regulatory-driven. The light bulb wasn't invented because the government demanded something be done about darkness. Nobel Prizes don't come because Congress says, okay, let's force an issue and make the research happen. So with all due respect to the scientific community, they are working on this, I believe, and innovation will bring forward solutions. I feel like we are being so heavy-handed. I'm imagining, and please correct me, Senator Rest, I don't want to mislead.
Don't worry.
food and beverage packaging. So the plastic rings that would go around the LaCroix bottle, or the plastic wrap and cardboard that would hold the Aquafina water bottle. So it's not just the water bottle. So let's take, I'll pick on Senator Rosen, the water bottle. So they have a 16-ounce, a 20-ounce, maybe they have a 12-ounce. All of those would be separate if they're packaged in a 6-pack, a 12-pack, a 24-pack, or the Costco pack. All of those would be separate. All of those would have to be reported. There would have to be a penalty paid on each of them. I'm looking at the overwhelming amount of money that's going to be collected. I get there's not a lot of rules about how the money's spent. That could be worked on. But what I think will happen is the manufacturer will say, all right, we need to be in Minnesota. We are going to do 16-ounce bottles in 24 packs, and that's all. And with regard to the hockey helmet, this manufacturer will say, we're only doing black, and we're going to do the 3-6, and we're going to do 6-12, and that's all we're doing because we're only paying twice. And another manufacturer will say, okay, we'll fill the niche for someone who likes green helmets. And so I'm afraid, as we're transitioning to the innovation and research, there are going to be some consequences that And I know everybody wants kids to not be exposed to toxins, but we're talking about adult food packaging too. And I'm sitting here with my phone case thinking, okay, so the parent who buys the frozen or whatever it is now case because their child has an iPod that they play games on, is that case registered too? So every different Disney version is registered for the Samsung. I feel like we've got a lot of stuff on a list here and a lot of money going in and a lot of record keeping, and I don't feel like the manufacturing industry is going to be ready for this.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Benson, I do appreciate your comments and your concerns. I do think that the entrepreneurial spirit, however, also defines the American business economy, and there will be found ways, maybe not because government mandates it, but we know that government provides the money. It provides the money to our universities. It provides the money through this bill for strategies and opportunities for research to produce products that are that serve the same mission, the same purpose for these products, but that do not, as far as possible, contain these toxic elements. And we all admit, you know, we had a ban on formaldehyde that was successful, but we know that formaldehyde occurs in nature, and we're not going out of our way to find ways to get rid of formaldehyde in nature. But the focus of this bill, too, is not, quite frankly, how the Mr. Chairman, Senator Benson, how these products affect you or me,
they are how they affect, and we had the professor talk about how they affect the growing bodies of children, and that is that. And these products affect adults differently, and particularly, you know, in like a dosage. You mentioned that the dosage of anything that's harmful, that harms a child of 40 pounds, far more than an adult of 170 pounds. That's pretty common sense, I think, and that's what this. That's what the governor's initiative, supported by the three departments that will be engaged in the implementation of this bill, Commerce and Health and PCA, that's what the aim is with these enhancements. But your concerns are well taken.
Further discussion? To have a motion. This bill goes to Health Committee. I know. I think that's the next stop for this bill.
Health and Human Services.
Yes,
Mr. Chairman.
Health and Human Services. I'm sorry.
Not being laid over.
What?
Not being laid over.
I think this was.
Okay.
Being moved. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I'd make a motion to pass Senate File 1099 as amended.
Hasn't been amended.
I don't think it has.
Okay. Just Senate File 1099. To the Health Policy
Health and
Committee.
Human Services Policy Committee. On that motion, is there any more discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members. I really appreciate the discussion.
Senator Scoy here.
Yes, he's right there.
There he is. Senator Scoy, thank you for waiting for
hour and a half.
Utility licenses for crossing public lands and waters, an exemption for that. You've dealt with this fee in the past. This was one of your areas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And yes, I have dealt with this issue in the past, at least twice thought we have had this resolved. But we are back again working on this. Just a real brief history. These fees were increased during the time of deficits. And from my perspective, really beyond anywhere what you would have expected the cost of the administration of the activity to be, the fees from a rural perspective really became a mechanism for funding the department and not tied to the activity of the crossing of the land. We have tried to fix that a couple of times. There has been a number of errors that have occurred that this hasn't resulted in. The last one, I thought that we had this fixed in the conference committee in the finance division of environment in 13 for implementation in 14. There was a drafting error, I understand, so this didn't get repaired or fixed then. What the impact is on much of these areas that has this public land is that pretty significant cost burden for a number of activities. I'll give you a couple of examples. The city of LaPorte has a snowmobile trail a multi-use trail that goes through the city, and on one side of the trail is a parking lot for people who want to park their vehicles and take their bikes and ride the trail. And on the other side, the city wanted to build a little picnic shelter with this opportunity for people to stop and have a little lunch and get a drink of water. The fee to run the power line over to that was $3,500, which was pretty exorbitant for a small town of 170 people to contemplate. And after the efforts that I had to try to repeal this, it became apparent to me that we needed to come back and try again. So here we are with Senate File 945. And mostly this bill accomplishes the goals that we thought we had achieved in 2013 with the changes on lines 111 through 114. And the reason that those lines are added back in or added in is because we do not intend the high voltage utility lines and for the pipelines to not have to pay the fees for the crossings, because those major structures, I believe it's appropriate. What we're trying to get at is the small lines that are going up to a resident for power, phone, or broadband. And I think it's completely appropriate for this to those to be exempt. It's for areas that have a large, as I said, a lot of public land. If you're building a house or a business in these areas that have these high amounts of public land, these fees can run into significant costs, and they really should be, because these state lands are in those areas, I think they should be borne by the state, and I would ask for your support.
Thank you. Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering, Senator Skoy, and I remember this a little bit from before, who doesn't get the money then? I'm trying to figure out who's short money and how does that money get replenished for that person doing the work?
Mr. Chair and Senator Scalzi, it would be a general fund impact. From my perspective, we've paid for this a couple times already. But the finance the committee, Senator Tomasoni's finance committee, will have to sort this out. And I expect that's where the motion would be to send this, would be to finance, because it primarily is a financial implication we have to sort out.
Senator Scoy, I was just seeing somebody did prepare a fiscal note, and it says $388,000 per biennium. I picture with that kind of fee crossing, there'd be a lot more than that, but that's the limit of the impact, as far as you know, I mean.
I think, Senator Marty, part of the reason this is less is because of my previous efforts.
So you got most of it, but there are a handful
okay. We haven't gotten it all. We're still working on it.
Is there further discussion? Senator Eaton.
I'm just curious, Senator Skoy, what's the actual cost of putting the line across the road? You said the fee was $3,500. Do you know what percentage that, or what the actual cost would be?
Well, I think for Mr. Chair and Senator Eaton, I think for most of these lines, now there's some of them would be crossing the road where you would be doing an underground boring or something, and I don't know exactly what those are. They're probably in the thousands of dollars to bore the line under the road. I think the majority of these are for lines that are traveling parallel to the road. They're using the far edge of the road right-of-way for a line right-of-way. I think that's what it is. A lot of times for power lines, they actually go just outside the road right-of-way of the highway jurisdiction, because they don't want to have overlapping easements. But what I would envision, these are relatively small rubber tracks. They call them ditch, which I think is a company that makes them. They have a spade on the back that vibrates. They go down through the dirt, the earth, and vibrate this and put a small wire in the ground. I actually had one of those machines bring a wire into our yard this summer. We had some power or some utility changes. And they come along through your yard and vibrate this wire in, and when they're done, the grass grows and you don't even know they were there. So it's pretty, if it's a wetland, then it's a different deal. But most of the road right away is pretty dry, and they just travel along pretty good. It's pretty minimal. And they'll do many, many miles in a day. So I don't put that.
I was just curious. Thank you.
Senator Sewin.
Mr. Chair and Senator Skoy, I'm not real familiar with this, but would this exemption, if the utilities don't have to pay to cross public lands or waters, would it lead to them moving to different areas, or would it lead to the utilities crossing the public lands more because they wouldn't have to pay the fees instead of going to the private landowners where then they would have to still pay the fees?
Mr. Chair and Senator Sewin, I think primarily what's happening is that many of these areas, take Cochinchin County, for example. I think it's about 90% of the land is publicly owned. So when you have an intermix of private land in there, there's no way to get wire there without crossing public lands. And the fees were getting to be exorbitant. I don't think it's going to be the case where the customers are going to locate close to public land just to avoid the fee, you know, paying, or the, well, they wouldn't have a fee on private land. But that would not be a thing that I would speculate that would be happening.
Okay.
Is there anyone in the audience who wish to speak with any concerns about the bill? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Kathy Lewis, Assistant Director, Lands and Minerals Division, DNR. The department is, with the understanding, our fiscal note was that the same amendment that was made in the House would be made in the Senate, and that was to modify the fees to only be the application fees that would be exempted. The licensees have also a market value fee that they pay for the use of the land. These are 50-year licenses, and so, for example, on the land crossing licenses, it is based on a value that's 15% of the current appraised value of the land, and that value goes then into that payment goes into the permanent school fund or the game and fish fund or goes through consolidated conservation accounts. So we would like to see that amendment considered in the Senate as it has been adopted so far in the House and the House committee.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the A1 amendment did appear in my packet today. It's the first I've seen of it. I did have brief conversations with Mr. Knopf about this. I think before we would adopt this, I would like to have a little more understanding about the impact of this amendment on the differing fees that the department does administer with regard to this. This would mean that the relief would only be on the application fee, and I need to understand what other fees the department is charging and what those fee numbers are in relation to the amount. And I think it would really be better if we had this in the finance. It's a finance issue about the fee amount.
Do you want the amendment handed out, or do you want to?
Mr. Chair, I was preferring to have this conversation about the application fee in the finance division as it is a fee, and they go so more appropriate there.
In other words, Ms. Lewis, this fiscal note that I see here, it would have been based on if it's just the application fee exempted, not the other overall fee.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. The numbers would be different if it's all fees that are accepted. But the primary difference would be that for an annual year, that the school trust fund would not be receiving $164,000. The consolidated conservation account would not receive $7,000. And the game and fish account would not receive $3,000. So that's the basic impact, and that's the market value fee that the licensees pay for using the land for the 50 years. The supplemental application fee, which is the $2,250 or the $3,500, those are all waived, and that would still be waived with the amendment.
Senator Scoy.
Mr. Chair, perhaps since we have a fiscal note based on the amendment being on, and it's on in the other body, perhaps we could run this without it, and I would get a fiscal note for what that is, and then we would have the opportunity to compare that.
It's Senator Osmer.
Mr. Chair, one other side benefit to having more of these utilities inside of public right-of-way is the fact that the local jurisdictions have better control over the activities that take place. Example, if you start doing a lot of digging, if you have these going through private property and homeowners are not careful, they can start hitting things where you have to have permits at a local level to do any type of public lands activity within publicly owned property. So I see it as actually a very good benefit to keep more of these within a public area because you have better controls on it and don't have as many adverse effects to the utilities.
This is going to be largely a finance issue, I think, how much it is, how much it costs to do that, and so on. And we we have the fiscal note the way it is in the House, but not the way it is in the Senate. So I think the Finance Committee is going to have to deal with it. Senator Huffman, is there anybody else who wanted to speak to the bill?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Scoy.
I will meet with the DNR, and we will sit down and hammer this out.
Appreciate that. Senator Huffman moved Senate File 945. He recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. Is there any further discussion of that motion? Not. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
With that, this committee is adjourned.
Thank you.